Thanks very much, everybody. So a little bit of change of pace. The last talk was quite broad and about simulation. My talk's going to be more about sort of what you can do at a paddock scale to close the yield gaps. And in particular, I think the message is that you need to be flexible and pragmatic about the systems that you apply. And in this case, I'm going to talk about conservation ag in Australia. Why would we be interested in a wheat initiative in Australia? Well, Australia only produces about 2% of global wheat, but we represent 14% of the wheat that's traded in the world. So what happens in Australian wheat production is significant on a global basis. So as most of you would know, Australian the wheat farming system in Australia, the environment and the soils are quite challenging. It's a dry environment, relatively infertile soils. Our agriculture is unsubsidised, and so it's quite a risky environment. And so relatively large farms, you can see the areas where wheat's grown in yellow there. So conservation agriculture as a principle, the principles of less tillage, stubble retention and good rotations, of course, have been adopted quite significantly in Australia for that reason. You can see here, looking at the national average wheat yield since reasonable records began, how the average wheat yield has shifted in Australia. I don't want to focus on the history, but if you just look at this period from which conservation agriculture, no-till, stubble retention systems began to be developed and adopted, you can see in that period that and notwithstanding the sort of 10-year millennium drought, how yields have increased with those technologies, and as I said, they've been adopted quite widely. My colleague James Hunt, who will follow me, began a project in around 2009-10, where the industry, the grains industry in Australia, challenges to ask, well, what's next? Have we hit a plateau here, or can we move these yields higher? As I said, no-till had already been fairly widely adopted at this stage. So particularly in areas where erosion was an issue in Western Australia and Queensland, almost complete adoption of systems that you can see here incorporate less or no tillage, stubble retained systems and increasingly with precision ag, inter-row sowing and so forth involved. In spite of that, and here is just to show you, there is a website here. In Australia, the yield gaps in wheat have been mapped fairly accurately using a simulation model that's sensitive to soil type, to rainfall and to various aspects of management. Zvi Hoffman and his colleagues, as part of a global yield gap initiative, have mapped that. And you can see, as Jerry Hatfield said earlier, we still have quite significant yield gaps in Australia, and it varies from place to place. And this is actually an interactive website where you can go and have a look if you want to check that out. It's also been done for canola in Australia. But essentially what it said is that there appeared to be still opportunities to improve, to increase that yield and to close this exploitable gap. And James and I were involved in a project for 5 years where we looked at the sort of the kind of wheat yields we were achieving, the sorts of systems that we had in place, and we did a pre-experimental modelling exercise before this project to show that if you just change aspects of a system, for example, just improve the rotation from continuous wheat to a better rotation, you can get what is a reasonably significant yield improvement, but it's not very spectacular. If you don't allow sheep to graze summer weeds that grow in the fallow, but rather have a strict summer weed control program with herbicides, you can store more water and nitrogen and again get a significant but not spectacular increase in yield, and so forth. With single changes in the system, the potential was there, but it wasn't very spectacular. But as James will follow and talk about, if you can change the genetics and a whole management package and put together a package of better genetics across this management, you can actually come up with a system that takes you from, you know, a transformational yield change, you would say. And we do have growers now in this area, which we had simulated, adopting this whole package and achieving yields close to this. So... in that system, you would see no-till was no-till and conservation ag was part of the package. But I guess what I wanted to talk about today was how we've had to continue to evolve and to be flexible about how we apply conservation ag. And these are some of the issues I wanted to talk about and to show you some of the work we've been doing. For example, under long-term no-till systems in Australia, compared to the pasture lay system we had with pastures rotated with sequences of crops, we can barely maintain soil organic levels. Mostly they decline compared to pastures. So that's an issue for us. We're getting stratification of nutrients and of acidity in the very surface where we adopt complete no-till systems. Heavy stubble, if we try to retain all the stubble, continues to be a barrier for us in many ways, for herbicide application, for nitrogen immobilisation, and so we need to continue to manage that in some way. And of course, as you all know, the total reliance on herbicides, inappropriate reliance on herbicides, has generated a lot of herbicide resistance, which we also have had to manage. And so we've needed to be flexible, I guess, in how we manage these issues within what still is a very good system and that still underpins what we do, but we've become a little bit more pragmatic. And so some of the answers to this, I guess, that I want to talk about to deal with these issues have been things like looking more at the nutrient balance if we're trying to maintain soil carbon. Is it a lack of carbon or is it a lack of stabilising nutrients? That's the problem. Using tillage strategically in the system to solve some issues without going back to a full cultivated systems. Managing stubble to thresholds that still give us most of the benefits but avoid the problems. And looking at diversity of both practices in how we manage weeds. So I just would like to go through some experiments we've done to exemplify some of these ways we've been being a little bit more flexible with our system. So I've had a long-term tillage experiment running, and this exemplifies at this site some of those issues. That's the sort of sequence of crops over the years. We've had a reasonably good sequence, if you like, a diverse sequence with legumes and oilseeds and wheat over the years. Nevertheless, we have seen rarely a yield increase and often a yield reduction there, particularly in wetter seasons, of stubble retain systems versus where we've been burning the stubble late. And this was of interest to us. Why weren't we? We were seeing a lot of soil improvements, but we weren't often seeing the crops respond. This is wheat yield response. And you can see negative yield responses where we retain stubble in the wetter years. And also at this site, irrespective of the tillage system, basically the soil carbon levels in the surface over those 28 years have declined from 1.3% to 0.9%, irrespective of whether we were cultivating or not or retaining stubble or not. So this was also a frustration, I guess, for us, but also of interest to understand what was going on there. And so as I said, to take up the first point about our failure to build soil carbon under these systems, we know that pastures in our system can build soil carbon significantly. That was the sort of the lay pasture system, build the organic matter under the pasture and then use it during the crops. But you can see a long-term experiment over there showing the loss of soil carbon under complete no-till systems. Much worse, of course, if you're burning and cultivating, but even if we were retaining all of the residue and had a good rotation, we were barely sort of holding the loss stable. So why should that be if we're retaining all this residue every year? Why are we losing soil carbon? And colleague of mine, Clive Kirkby, basically hypothesised that, you know, we had enough carbon, but soil organic matter is more than carbon. We only measure the carbon because that's the easy bit to measure. It's soil organic matter, stable soil organic matter, has a constant stoichiometry of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus and sulphur. And we've been so efficient with our nutrient applications to our crops that perhaps we didn't have enough left to build soil organic matter when we did have the carbon there. So he devised a pretty straightforward experiment at our long-term site. I handed him the stubble incorporation treatment that had been running for many years. He split it in half, and we had 9 tonnes roughly of wheat and canola residue going in every year. He simply applied some supplementary nutrients, N, P and S, to one side of it to satisfy the stoichiometry that soil microbes and soil humus require. And over a six-year period, we continued to lose carbon on the side without nutrients, but we built 5.5 tonnes per hectare of carbon, so a difference of 8.7 tonnes of carbon over 6 years. So demonstrating that the issue here was a lack of nutrients, not a lack of soil carbon. Moving on then to this stratification problem, and whether it's lime or phosphorus, both immobile nutrients, in our long-term no-till systems, particularly with disc seeders, we are essentially concentrating these elements in the very surface. So if you come along and measure the 0 to 10 in a soil profile like that, in both of those systems it'll tell you the pH is 5. But as you can see, for the no-till system, in fact, right where you're putting your very sensitive legume crops, the pH is about 4.4, and so they won't nodulate, they won't fix nitrogen. And so by doing some strategic cultivation to break up this stratification, you can overcome this problem and avoid this issue of having these things concentrated too close to the surface. So can we cultivate? Can we cultivate without destroying the soil? A lot of people are concerned that, you know, if you cultivate up a long-term no-till soil, you'll destroy, or you'll lose all the carbon, you'll destroy all of the soil, you know, the sky will fall in. Essentially, at that long-term trial, for 20 years, these were the sort of average wheat yields that we were getting over those 20 years. You can see a small impact of tillage, a bigger impact of retaining residue, as I showed you before. What we did was we went in and we went into the long-term no-till treatments that you can see there, either with burnt or retained stubble, and we just cultivated them once, but with a rotary hoe. Two passes of a rotary hoe once in 2011, and then we went back to no-tilling, and we followed the soil physics, chemistry and biology for 5 years, as well as the yields. I won't show you all the soil data, but so we did that once in 2011, which created another treatment, if you like, the no-till or strategic tilled once. And if you just compare the green yields, you can see there we had really no impact at all on the yield of the subsequent crops over a five-year period, after which the project stopped. So it is possible to cultivate a soil strategically for a purpose in a no-till system and not have dire consequences, provided you do this safely, of course, in the context of erosion risk and other things. So with respect to the stubble and to these systems generally, a lot of growers were concerned that allowing sheep into their system, we have these mixed farming systems, if you go to all this trouble of doing control traffic, no-till systems, and then you let sheep walk all over it, are you just going to undo all the good that you've done and again ruin your soil? So we set up an experiment to look into that. James again and other colleagues, we had a little bit of data on this and with some modelling suggested it probably wasn't going to be the end of the world, but we really couldn't find good experimental data that had actually checked whether the sheep were going to do significant damage. Certainly just looking at what sheep do, you can jump to the conclusion that you're having some bad effects on the soil. Anyway, we set up an experiment, completely no-till control traffic experiment, where we either let sheep come in and graze residues in summer, or not. We did a lot of measurements on the soil, sort of water infiltration, and whilst the sheep did cause some very shallow surface compaction and we could measure some impacts of that on rainfall infiltration rates, they weren't at a level that with the rainfall intensity we get affected very significantly soil water storage. They did in some seasons, but it very rarely ended up in a yield impact. And so you can see there the black numbers are wheat yields, the red numbers are canola yields, but just to show you, there's very few instances there where the grazed stubble compared to ungrazed stubble is causing an effect. And surprisingly, in several seasons, the grazed treatment actually yielded more, which was quite a surprise. But that turned out to be an effect of grazing on increasing soil nitrogen levels pre-sowing. And so we were intrigued by that. We found that in eight of the 13 phase years, we had more mineral N in the soil under the graze treatment than not. We followed it through some summers just to see what happened. This is 1 year where we allowed the sheep into graze, and you can see how the soil mineral N following the grazing increased on that soil. And it appears to be not only the turnover of some of the wheat straw through the sheep's system into urine and manure patches, but also the sheep are removing some of the high carbon residue, which is an immobilising source in the soil. And if you're not immobilising as much N, you end up with more mineral N. And we think it's this lack of immobilisation rather than what the sheep are converting, because we couldn't explain the amount of residue they ate. We couldn't explain it in any other way. And this we're getting more and more evidence that that's what's happening. And in this system, the growers maximised profit if they had strict summer weed control to store water and nitrogen, if they grazed the residue but always left at least 70% cover on the soil to get that soil water benefit, and the increase in profit was quite significant, depending on how much you valued the stubble as a food source. And finally, the last point I made was managing herbicide resistance, and this sort of shows that under our Australian systems, where we switched to no-till, we relied totally on herbicides, we didn't rotate them in clever ways, and we started to develop resistance in all sorts of weeds to all sorts of herbicides, including glyphosate. And I guess we now know that the answer to this is to have diversity of both crops, herbicides and practices. So not only a good rotation and a good rotation of herbicides, but also bringing in other practices like harvest weed seed control, vigorous and competitive crops, sometimes strategic tillage. Again, in an experiment that James and his colleagues set up, we were interested to see whether we could manage this problem once it's developed in a long-term no-till system, just using our agronomy and better approaches. At this particular site, there was 1,800 herbicide-resistant ryegrass seeds per square metre when we started, so quite a problem. And we set up three different strategies. Business as usual, which was triazine-tolerant canola with two-wheat sequence, using relatively low density, the generic post-emergent herbicides, which were cheaper, yep, and low N. An aggressive strategy to try and buy our way out of the problem, so Roundup Ready canola, more expensive upfront herbicides and higher N levels. And then this sustainable treatment where we diversified the rotation with vetch grown and cut for hay. So by cutting it for hay, we were taking away a lot of the grass seeds while they were in the middle of flowering. We were also terminating the crop earlier so water and nitrogen could build up to support the canola crop. And in this system, it's possible to retain all of the residue because each crop produces a residue that the following crop can deal with. So that's just that vetch, the vetch idea, cut for hay. So this sort of diversity of end uses for these legumes is a way to get them into the system if taking them through the grain is not always the most profitable thing to do. And just to show you, this was a phased experiment over so all phases were represented. You can see we started with 1,800 ryegrass plants. So if we just stick to business as usual, you can see the red numbers on the end, we just make the weed problem worse, irrespective of what else we do. But it also happens to be the least profitable, even though it has the lowest costs. The aggressive strategy, whilst we made a little bit more money, we had to spend a lot more money, so the profit-to-cost ratio, in other words, the financial risk was higher. And again, we still had some weed problems even after that full rotation. Whereas the sustainable system, by introducing the vetch cut for hay, lower input costs, particularly with nitrogen, higher earnings before interest and tax, and the lowest risk, the highest profit to cost ratio, and we managed to get a herbicide resistant weed population down. So that was my final slide. So I guess the message is that conservation agriculture in Australia and no-till systems still underpin what we do, but we've had to be quite pragmatic and flexible about how we've applied them in order to keep them profitable. Thanks.